Hi, I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms, historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. The conversations will be archived here for the social science community. Thanks for listening, and enjoy.
So, Jim, how would you introduce yourself?
My name is Jim Scott. I teach at Yale University and was trained as a political scientist. And if I describe my intellectual itinerary, I guess I would say that I began as a political scientist, and then, partly because of the Vietnam War and being a Southeast Asianist, I decided to devote my career at that point to the study of peasants, since they were the most numerous class in world history. And I realized that if I was going to devote my time to understanding peasants, that I would have to spend some time in a peasant village. And to do that, I had to become a fake anthropologist. So I spent a couple of years in a Malay village, which was formative for me. And I was told that it was a career-ending move by my political scientist friends. So I loved, actually, the idea of anthropologists that, you know, a political scientist walks into a village with a questionnaire, usually. I walked into a village with my eyes wide open and tried to understand the agricultural system as it was changing in Malaysia. And so there's a kind of wide-eyedness to anthropology that I admire, that it starts out with as few prejudgments as possible and is open to learning and following, in a sense, the interests where they lead you, not that you don't come in with some prejudices. I understand that. And then actually, to make this short, I describe myself as a political science with anthropology envy, and now I describe myself as an anthropologist with historian envy. That is to say, I actually think that no anthropologist should be allowed out the door in the morning unless they're strapped to an historian, because anthropologists are very good at understanding what a particular situation is in a snapshot and all the cultural connections and so on. But it's pretty much an inch deep and a mile wide. And I became increasingly interested. That's why I did that recent book on the origins of agriculture in Mesopotamia, because it seemed to me that somehow one of the great things about history, and which in my mind makes it the most subversive of all disciplines, is that it shows us how certain things came to be that might not have happened in the first place, that were contingent, and that it therefore unsettles what we take as givens that are solidly normalized and denormalizes them. And so for that reason, I find historical depth. I'm actually hoping to write a book on the Irrawaddy River with the idea that what we've done to rivers is a way of understanding what we've done to nature and landscape. But I want it to be about the river and not about Homo sapiens. So I'm starting back in geological time and how the river came to be even before there were any Homo sapiens around. So that's how far off the cliff I have gone.
That's a phenomenal bio, right? I would not have introduced you that way, so that's very helpful. It reminded me of this. There's a piece about the Hindus that I think Wendy Doniger is her name, but she starts like 40,000 years ago, right, and then kind of like comes forward. But it's a phenomenal sweep. So it's interesting. So our first question, which you've encompassed in your bio, is what is the topic or question that you were interested in for your research project when you were going into the field. But it sounded like you had, it was, I wouldn't phrase it as a question per se, although would you, did you go to the field with a question, or was it kind of a puzzle of sorts?
I did, actually. It's a reasonably interesting story about having my trajectory being detoured in spite of myself. So I knew that the area that I was going to, which had been actually studied in terms of agricultural economics, it was the biggest rice-producing area in Malaysia. And they were just introducing combine harvesters. So what was happening, my argument was that if I went back into the 1830s in England with all the rebellions against the mechanization of the harvest, this is my way of kind of understanding technological change in class relations. And so I knew that these changes were happening. And I, of course, went in, I wanted to get the household income and crop history and land holding statistics. So I started like a good little political scientist, going household to household and sitting down and figuring out how their land was, and went out to the fields with them. And I found that after I'd been there for 2 months or 3 months, there were things happening in the village, disputes and quarrels and political splits. And I thought somehow that these were getting in the way of me and my systematic census of the village. And I finally realized only after 6 months that what I could really learn, that every time there was a dispute or a fissure or a change that people talked about, that's how I could understand the cracks and relationships in the village, by following the things that were actually mattered to the villages and that were happening, rather than just collecting my statistics on agrarian change. And so I realized that the things that I resented as diverting me from my persistent path were actually the things that mattered most in the final analysis.
And after writing it up, you actually went back to that village, right? And talked to people to make sure that your presuppositions about the data you were collecting reflected their understandings too.
Yeah, although, as I think I mentioned, I fumbled that in a sense that I still think it's a wonderful idea, and I hope somebody who's braver than I am does it, which is what I had planned originally was to go off for 3 months, figure out exactly what I thought I wanted to say, and then go back to the village and give them the last chapter, if you like, the first reviews of Scott's anthropology by the villagers themselves. And I thought it would be a wonderful idea. And the fact is, I had so many things wrong that villagers said, no, that's wrong. I faced the prospect of writing a fairly stupid book and then giving the villagers all the intelligent things to say at the end. And wasting people's time. And I decided to smuggle all the things they told me into the book itself. And so I took away the last chapter from the villagers. So it's an indication of how, what it is. It is certainly a kind of exoneration of the procedure. That is to say, if you're writing about people, you should actually, you want to listen to what they understand about what you've said about them. And it seems to me that even if I didn't give them the last chapter the way I should have, most of the things I learned were in that last 6 months when I told them what I thought I knew.
So in the spirit of not thinking I know what my listener, as the listener, thinking in that spirit, I think I know what kind of advice you got when people were telling you you shouldn't go into the field and you shouldn't go do that. It's a career ender. But I am a little bit curious about the advice that you got and whether you solicited advice from the field. I mean, I know that one of the big differences between the time that you were doing field work and the time people do field work today is that you can just jump on Skype or jump on the internet. You can be in touch with people back home with just a couple of pennies. And, you know, back then, I think it might have been a much more remote, impossible journey. And so you did it after you had tenure, right? I mean, I think that our listeners might not know that, that this was not how you started your career as a graduate student. This is work that you did once you actually had some labor protection. But I'm still curious to hear about the resistance that you faced from the discipline.
Well, the moment, actually, was one of the first things I did after leaving Wisconsin and coming to Yale. So, and I knew I wanted to do it. And a number of my colleagues at Wisconsin who explained that this was a career-ending move, that nobody gave a shit, if I can use that word, about a small village of 80 families in a rice-growing area of Malaysia. What could possibly be important about that? And that it would not be taken seriously by political science. I was sure at that point that I wanted to study peasants and that I had to spend time in the village. I didn't know what I would eventually make of it. And the interesting thing is I wrote to the chairman at Yale and said, look, I know you only get so much time off on sabbatical, but as a condition of me coming to Yale, I want to have 2 years off in a row, one of them at no pay at all. I'm happy with that, and I'll pay my dues later in terms of having taken so much time off at the beginning. I arrived at Yale, and the chairman, I got that in writing, I was smart enough at the time, and then the chairman said, oh, I was mistaken, you really can't do that. So I took the letter to the provost and said, look, this is the letter I got, this is what I was promised. And he was good enough to say, you got it, right? We'll deliver. And I think it was interesting for me. I actually the book turned out, since you're probably familiar with Weapons of the Week, but it was a big moment for me because in some respects, nothing was happening much in this village in terms of anything world-shaking. And yet it sort of forced me to dig and understand forms of class tension, warfare, and antagonism that don't, in a sense, declare their presence in a formal organization or social movements and so on. So I think that was, if anything, was a contribution of that book. That was its contribution to look at a kind of politics that political scientists usually turn their nose up at.
Jim, so did you go there with the intent that you were going to kind of like have one-on-ones with people, that you were going to sit with families? What was your kind of, how did you imagine that you were going to collect the information that you were going to collect?
Well, I was a little disciple of a man named Chayanov, who was, he actually was killed by Stalin in the late 30s. And he was himself a student of what was called the Austrian School of Household Studies. And he did for the Russian peasantry meticulous studies of the allocation of time and work and child labor and family labor and decisions about crops and so on. And I thought it was a kind of magnificent effort to sort of understand the micro politics of agriculture and decision making. And so I was following, in a sense, he has a book called The Theory of the Peasant Economy. And I was just starting out by, in a sense, collecting a family economic history of each of the villagers. And so I was following, in a sense, the world according to Chayanov at the time. And it turned out to be a radically different book than the one that Chayanov would have written, of course.
Do you feel that in the midst of your kind of like doing his interview style that you got the glimpse of the other thing?
Yes, because I think I mentioned this somewhere. What was really interesting to me is that, like most anthropologists, you have to find a place to live in the village. and you're usually under the wing of a fairly prominent person in the village because they're likely to have the extra space, right? Connections, either an extra house or an extra room. In our case, it was an extra room. And I was there with my three kids and my wife, by the way. My wife spoke a fair amount of Malay as well. And what I noticed after a while, I realized that most of my time that wasn't actually interviewing was being spent with the big landowners of the village. They weren't huge landowners, but they were the prominent people in the village. And so I decided I needed to spend some more time with the poor people in the village, people who had no land or very, very little land. And I started threshing with them in the fields. And when you thresh in this particular context, you work with another person and you share a payment depending on the number of bags of paddy that you've threshed. And I made a point of threshing but never collecting my share. In fact, I was not very good, so my share would have been a quarter rather than a half anyway. And so I tried to spend a lot of time with poor people. And then what happened was I was hearing things from poor people that I noticed that they never said in the presence of wealthy people. And the wealthy people in the village obviously had been talking to one another when I started this. And after a month or so, they clearly got the idea that this guy is getting out of our hands and spending too much time with people who don't like us. And we have to set him straight. And so there was an evening which they kind of set aside and said, we want to have a talk. And there were four or five of them. And they sat me down and gave me the view of the village according to the rich, more or less. It was not actually totally unified, but it was interesting. They wanted to set me straight. And they had heard from some of their poor informants, right, that I was making critical remarks about the loss of labor and jobs and so on. And so it was interesting. And then I decided that this was the hidden transcript stuff, in the sense that I realized that I got a completely, there were three different stories. The story I heard from poor people when they were by themselves with me, the story I heard from rich people when they were by themselves with me, and I went, that was different from stories I didn't hear, which is poor people among themselves and rich people among themselves without me there. And then there was another story that rich and poor people performed together when they were in the same dialogue. And I realized that I could make this triangulation work for me and learn more about the village by choosing the isolation of each contact that I, or trying to make sure that I varied the situation systematically to learn more about some of the village politics.
So can I follow up on that? Did you ever feel like your Malay wasn't good enough to follow the conversations? I mean, I always struggle across, I worked in Tajikistan, right? And the one of the main problems there is that there's a cacophony of different dialects of what you would call Tajik, which is Persian in grammar structure, so I could follow. But then people can also switch into Uzbek and Russian. And there's just a lot of ways that if you're trying to hide a transcript, you can. From me anyway. I'm not super linguistically gifted. Was that a problem in your field work that you encountered, or did you basically feel like you could follow?
Well, first of all, I didn't have the problem that you had of if you like, a linguistic portfolio in which people could switch to another language register. Everyone just spoke Malay. On the other hand, they, of course, had ways of speaking quickly and idiomatically that left me in the dust. And it dogged me all the time that they were doing that. And I had, you know, I had a friend who would sometimes tell me what they were saying that I didn't follow. He was my informant, my main informant. And he was a truly wonderful friend. I don't think without him I would have made much progress. And so I was pretty good. I have this problem with Burmese now. I'm pretty good one-on-one. But when you get a crowd of four or five people and they're all jumping in especially Burmese is a Tomil language, so that's even harder for me. It would be better if I were 5 years old. I'd be better at Burmese. But it's I found that in groups, they could evade me by linguistic moves that I was unable to follow. But that one-on-one or maybe two-on-one, I could slow things down, and they could understand me, and I could usually understand them. And I could actually, I got good enough at Malay, so if I didn't understand something, they could explain it to me in simpler terms.
So did you mostly rely on one-on-ones? I mean, obviously when you were threshing, it was one-on-one, but when you afterwards were sifting through all your data and trying to decide what you were going to use and what you weren't going to use, did you privilege the one-on-one stuff that you really knew you understood? Or so not so much?
Actually, there was very rarely a truly one-on-one.
Yeah.
So if, that is to say, it was interesting. For poor people, when I visited them, Malay houses are up on stilts. And if you go up the ladder into a house, then they're more or less obliged to give you tea or little biscuits or something. You are then a guest and they have to do something. And so poor people couldn't afford this. And so I would meet them under the house. There's usually a bench, right, where they have some farm equipment and so on. And I would meet them under. And when someone saw this, you know, white man under the house next door, that they would come out, you know, come over because they were interested. Women would come over on the periphery and occasionally add things here and there. So my chances of being left alone, right, in a conversation with a single individual was fairly rare. The only way I got that was to be out in the fields with them if they were organizing the planting or repairing a bund or something like that. And so the one-on-ones were extremely rare. And so the question was, when a little group accumulated, the more people accumulated, the less interesting the conversation became, right? In some ways, because there were people didn't want to say things in front of.
That's interesting. So, to Jim, like, the question was going to be, what troubles or opportunities did you encounter along the way? But it seems like we're kind of talking about that right now. So, did you see this kind of multiplicative transformation of language as problematic or insightful kind of like at the time? Or did you just kind of like, I guess part of it is like, how quickly were you to figure all this stuff out, right? Were you like kind of like seeing like as more people came that the conversations were shifting and then you adapt yourself and then realize that in some kind of like recursive dynamic, okay, let me come back to them about that.
Well, I think it was that moment when the relatively well-to-do elite of the village tried to straighten me out, right? That was the sort of moment at which I began to think more analytically about all the situations that I'd been in and this kind of relationship. I also, you know, one of the things I did actually, this is a technique, an anthropologist named F.G. Bailey did a set of lectures of people going out to do field work for the first time. And someone sent me, actually, it was a photocopied version of these lectures, which someone transcribed. They were just spoken. And one of the things he did was to say that you have your field notes, right, that you take every day. And he said, you have to have an intellectual journal. That is to say, it's a separate journal in which you have a dialogue with yourself, which is, what do I understand? What do I don't understand? What have I fucked up? What do I want to learn next? How could I possibly learn it? What doesn't make any sense? And so I kept that intellectual journal turned out, and the guy, and F.G. Bailey said, if you're not spending a third of your time writing notes, you're not doing it right. And so being a novice, I followed his instructions and I spent a lot of time doing notes late at night. I mean, I was fucking exhausted every day. And the problem with being an anthropologist is that you're at work from the moment you open your eyes in the morning to when you close them at night. I used to go to the outhouse every once in a while just to be left alone for 10 or 15 minutes because it's the only place where I could be sure to be left alone.
Yeah, participant observation is exhausting if you actually try to do it. It's amazing to me how much slander there is in the training methods in political science right now about the methodology, and the words like rigor get thrown around, and it's hilarious. But that's a topic for maybe another conversation. Yeah, our time here is valuable.
You know, that, by the way, my partner, Anik Singh, is apropos of, you know, the fact that we live in this electronic connection world. She was called a couple of years back by a student who was waiting for an interview with a Japanese official and wanted to know what questions to ask him. She was just waiting in the anteroom and wanted advice from her thesis advisor, you know, like 20 minutes before this little interview. And, you know, the great thing about this anthropology historically is that you're on your own. You've got to figure this out, right? And the closest you are is a letter that takes at least 2 or 3 weeks to go back and forth.
Well, again, I mean, I think that was probably more true at the time that you were doing anthropology than it is today. I mean, today I think a lot of anthropologists are on Twitter, and you know, it's just like some of this is disciplinary socialization, and some of it is right. Technology. But I don't want to hog the mic at all. When you got back from the field and you were reflecting, what are the comical stories that kept reoccurring for you in your narrative? Like, what are the funny things that you kept remembering afterwards that as anchor points?
I'm thinking. There were so many.
Your book is full of them, right? I mean, your book is very funny, and you have a lot of details that are obviously meant to be humorous, but... Which ones really stuck with you when you were synthesizing?
Well, the thing that was, the things that are painful are actually things that end up teaching you a lesson about how the village works. So we had someone who would, we made our own tiny little kitchen. And it was suggested to us that a village girl might come and help with the sort of meal preparations, right? And we used her about 2 or 3 times a week. And we then, there was a period in which we left the village for 4 months. And we had a little kerosene two-burner cooker. And we decided that since we weren't going to use it for 3 months, and the landlord with whom we were living in the house, they had their own kitchen, we decided we would give Rokia, the name of the woman, the young girl, we would give her, since they didn't have a kerosene stove at home, we'd give her that, we just loaned it to her for 3 months. And it seemed to us to be a completely straightforward transaction. And the landlord became furious with us. And the reason he became furious with us is because what he saw in his mind, because we gave the stove a few days before to Rokia to carry back to her house at the other end of the village. And everybody assumed, or at least my landlord thought, that when they saw Rokia taking the stove back to her house, it was because we didn't trust him and his family to not confiscate it while we were gone. And that would be seen as a public mark of contempt and distrust for his family. Well, you know, it was all, by that time, the deed was done. And however, my wife and I were tearing our hair out because it seemed to be no way to undo it without taking the thing back from Rokia. And we had this question eventually of what would happen toward the end. we didn't have many belongings, but there, a lot of villagers said, could I have this when you go? Could I have that when you go? And we had this sort of fantasy image of getting up really late at night and piling the few things we had in a pile and leaving, like, right, as quickly as possible, and just letting the villagers fight over, right, without having to decide who gets what, because it got to be such a crazy situation. I don't know about you in Uzbekistan, but, you know, you actually have to get away from these people once in a while to clear your head. And for me, this was, it's another story that's sweet rather and funny too, I guess, is that every 2 months or so, I would just speed out of the village quickly, because if I went slowly, people would ask me where I was going and want to come with me. I had an old VW. And I would go 4 miles away to a Chinese shop house and have a beer, just because I couldn't have a beer in the village, being a Malay village. And it turned out that the last night I was spending with the young man in the village, they bought a six-pack of beer for me, because they all knew where I was going and that I was having a beer. And a couple of them shared a few sips of it, right? And as if to say, we know where you were going. It's okay. We still like you. I thought it was a gesture that almost brings tears to my eyes.
Jim, that's great. So you get back, and then you're synthesizing and trying to figure out kind of like what was what. First off, kind of like, what was that process like? Did you come back with your field notes in your journal, and then you're kind of like, what was that meditative process? Did you lay it all out chronologically? Were you kind of like triangulating between the kind of like three different audiences? How'd you kind of get there?
That's interesting. I've never thought this through. You know, none of us know how our minds work anyway. So I had started, before I left, I did, as a good little political scientist, I did a couple of articles on corruption or something in the APSR, actually. I published once in the APSR. You wouldn't believe it now, but I did. And it was about corruption, and I began to think of corruption, petty corruption, as, if you like, influence at the enforcement stage, since ordinary poor people don't have any influence on the laws that they live under. The only thing they can do is subvert them at the enforcement stage, right? And so I was already into resistance work of a certain kind. And then, you know, through talking to friends, I began to understand the history of desertion from militaries, particularly in the Civil War, actually, which figures in Weapons of the Week. All of the forms of, I then read more widely in an effort to understand the things that the people did to try to slow down the process of mechanization and the loss of their jobs. And so I think that's what got me into, if you like, resistance studies. And then Domination of the Arts of Resistance is actually an effort to sort of paint that on a sort of larger, more general canvas. I mean, it's nothing original in Domination of the Arts of Resistance, except that it's just an elaboration of the argument of Weapons of the Week, really.
If you were... So the piece that you haven't talked about, as we've talked through your CV, is Seeing Like a State. So at what point did you decide that you wanted to, I realize we're jumping a little out of fieldwork, but I can't help myself. At what point did you decide that you wanted to actually take the set of questions about enforcement and look at them from the point of view of the powerful, not looking up from the bottom of the well?
Yeah, no, I mean, actually, what you said is I've I've read it a couple of times about people who want to understand that, okay, I did the business, now I'm going to do the state. And I've looked from the bottom, now I'm going to look from the top. That's not the way in which at least it evolved in my own fevered brain. So what I think of as seeing like a state is, it turns out it's the most, I'm best known for that book, I think, than anything else, really.
It's how I first encountered you when I was a wee little undergrad, before I was a political scientist, actually. This is back when I was doing other stuff.
And so that book, actually, I mean, I was one of, at Yale with a lot of friends, we founded this program in agrarian studies. And we then had a weekly colloquium every year. It's now in its 28th year, I think, or something like that. And so I listened to all kinds of read papers and listened to discussions of all kinds of development programs going awry, the history of development. And so I think of this as something that gradually evolved in it's if you like this, the reason I got involved in agrarian studies, I never wanted to run a single thing in my life. I was persuaded to help do agrarian studies because I thought, well, if I can help choose the people who are coming in and what we're reading and what we're teaching, that's like a seminar I'm giving myself. So, you know, selfishly, intellectually, I'm happy with that. And so it was, if you like, the education that agrarian studies gave me by bringing before my screen all of these people. And I can tell you, if you remember Seeing Like a State, there was actually a kind of moment of epiphany when I read this thing on, what is it, the quantifying mind of the 18th century? And it's about scientific forestry. And I thought,
yes,
that's it. Right. And I realized that if people understood that story and I could put that across, it wasn't original with me, that was the process that sort of drove the whole book, if you like. And my partner would say that the way I write is to, I get a nail and I hammer it till everyone's screaming. And so Seeing Like a State is a kind of repetition in different contexts of the same argument, if you like.
Okay, so I don't want to talk over Christian, but I do want to try to get back to the structured interview form. When you look back on that Malaysia trip, the formative work, what is the advice that you got in advance that turned out to be right on the money, other than the ethnographic journal writing, where you meditate with your own work? What other advice was good, and what advice was really bad?
Well, you know, most of the advice, I mean, once I decided where I wanted to go, I already spoke Malay tolerably well. Then it happened to be an area that was actually fairly well studied. It was the first big irrigation scheme in Malaysia. And so the question was, the advice I had were from the people who were with essentially a developmental lens looking at this irrigation scheme. And so they had a lot of knowledge of the agronomic history of the area. And I remember I decided what I should do, at their advice actually, was sit in Penang, which is a nearby city with a big university, and read all the background stuff written about this area of Kedah, the province I was working in. And I did that, and I, at the advice with a friend, I found a woman who came from the capital town of Kedah. Kedah has a particular accent that's hard to follow. In fact, people made fun of me when I gave lectures in Burmese and Kuala Lumpur because I talked like a hick with a Kedah accent that they found completely amusing. Anyway, she taught me the Kedah dialect, but of course it was the provincial capital town dialect. And when I got to the village, I didn't understand a thing. I actually had to work really hard with my first friends to sort of work out all the different words that the villagers had. So there was a step of nobody helped me. I guess I'm answering the opposite question of the bad advice I had, that in fact, I had to learn the dialect kind of on the ground from people in the village. And they, the advice I got was, advice is not kind of generally interesting, I suppose, but I think the reason everybody needs a couple of close informants who you become very friendly with and can understand a little bit of where you're coming from is that they saved me from some terrible mistakes. And so, for example, I remember telling this after a couple of months. After everyone would go to bed, I had a tiny little single wick kerosene lamp that I did my notes by. And it was really, really late. And to clear my head, I would sort of take a quarter mile walk up and down the village lane, just a dirt path. And I told this to my main informant. And he said, "Oh my God, how long have you been doing this?" And I said, "Oh, for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks." And he said, "If people know that you're walking out in the middle of the night, you're going to be seen as a ghost. You're going to be seen as somehow a master of dark arts, and don't throw you out of this village so fast. It'll, you know, make your hair curl." That's not what words he used, but the same thing. And so I was completely naive. And first, another thing I would do is I have a habit of whistling. I like whistling. Mm-hmm. And for Malays, what whistling does is call snakes into the house. And so I had, and I stumbled several times, and I would have to catch myself when I started to whistle, because the householder would come in and scream at me. So anyway, so you need, I mean, I think there's, and this is not such a goddamn exotic culture. Everybody who goes in, I mean, it would happen in France or Germany that you actually need someone to help you out or you're going to make some serious mistake.
I almost got beat up for whistling in a hotel room in Missouri, you know, and it's the exact same thing, man. I mean,
whistling in Missouri?
No, I was whistling inside the house. You don't whistle inside the house. That calls up the devil. I had no idea that that was true, but I, Motel 6, I'll never forget it.
Too funny. So Jim, if you would think about how your experience in the field kind of influenced your general understanding of what research is and how it should be done, what do you think would come to mind?
I'm thinking again. I guess that the what I don't want to do actually is to somehow talk about my trajectory as being a trajectory that anyone else ought to follow. And in fact, you know, for all of the logic that some people would attribute to my intellectual path, it's not a logic I experienced, and to tell the truth, I moved on to the next most enjoyable thing to think about. So it was a kind of fun ethic, I'm embarrassed to say, and what literature attracted me. And I followed, I mean, I can make a larger case for that, which is, you know, if you're looking over your shoulder and asking, what does the discipline expect of me? What do the people who are going to be judging me and publishing me expect of me? Then you're halfway toward alienated labor. because you're choosing your subject and your approach and so on, in which you're looking at it with their eyes. It's like, you know, it's like what Jean-Paul Sartre says in Jew and Anti-Semite, that, you know, if there are two ways of reacting as a Jew in a world of anti-Semitism. One is to be a Jew in your face, and the other is to not do anything Jewish. And he calls the latter installing the anti-Semite in your own head, so you censor yourself. And it seems to me that, in a sense, that if, first of all, you're not going to make any money in this racket, and if you're not having fun, what the hell are you doing? You might as well go out and find a scam like Trump or sell used cars or, you know. So it's somehow, it's not that the work is going to be excellent just because it's unalienated, but if it is alienated, chances are you're not going to have your heart in it and it's not going to be your best work. And so what is exciting and attractive and gives you the passion is something that you care about. And obviously it's not as if, you know, I'm a little asteroid that doesn't pay attention to what the world is thinking about. But I think most of our disciplines do all too much of that. And they're ingrown to the degree that, and I mean, my way of putting it to political scientists, if you spend 9/10 of your time reading mainstream political science, you are going to reproduce mainstream political science. There's hardly anything else that can happen, right? And so I try to spend, and I did, mostly out of boredom originally, a lot of my time reading, when I was working on peasants, I read novels about peasants, or I read, you know, poetry about peasants. So that somehow the ideas tend to come in from somewhere else. And if you're not spending part of your intellectual time somewhere else, chances are you're going to reproduce the mainstream of your discipline.
So, only because we have the power to edit this afterwards, am I going to ask a follow-up question, because I can't actually think of a better soliloquy to just end the podcast on what you said. But I do have a very burning question to follow up, if you'll let me. You know, on behalf of all of the pre-tenured, half-alienated laborers out there who do feel a need to write to the discipline that they're in, the advice that you're giving, kind of as a utopian shooting star, is so important and so powerful. And I just want to thank you for saying it. But, I think a lot of people who strive to have policy relevance, either in economics or in sociology or in political science, or in a world where they feel like they're always brushing up against trade-offs, or someone who will define the conversation like a deer blind to sort of try to lead them into definition of trade-offs. So a typical way of the way that your work has been assimilated into political science would be to say, yeah, Jim Scott's great, but how much life expectancy are you really supposed to give up for freedom? And, you know, that's like a gotcha question. But, you know, how do you advise professionally vulnerable young people who kind of want to use your work but don't yet have the freedom to have their cake and eat it too?
Well, a little exercise is a thing as a point of departure is to take, if you like, that proposition that you enunciated of, you know, how much freedom you need to give up for how many dead people, and kind of turn it on its head. That is to say, for every proposition out there, try to turn it upside down and see whether it makes sense the other way around. And so, I mean, in a sense, all of the innovations that are likely to be lasting are people who question the existing assumptions and the way questions were posed. And so it's not that they're prima facie always wrong, but they won't work for you or for anybody else unless they're closely examined turned on their heads, looked at from all angles, and examined for, are there other ways of looking at this problem? And I think, I mean, it would be nice for someone to write an intellectual history of political science and the way it's in which, and economics for that matter, about how over time they abandon certain fields, economic history, political economy, the economists left far behind by and large, right? And the political science gradually have pared down the number of things that they count as within their bailiwick and capacity. And I guess the last thing I would say, although, you know, I'm lucky to be in my department treats me very well. A lot of them don't consider me to be a political scientist, but they think I'm cute and I'm a nice pet to have. And so they treat me well. But it seems to me that one thing I would say to political scientists is that you don't have to be a political scientist to practice political science. That is to say, I mean, I'm thinking of people like, I know Charles Mann, 1491, the pre-Columbian world, people, Chuck Tilley, for example, people who occupy that sort of middle ground of policy analysis that come from a different angle. So the point is that, once upon a time, Ian Shapiro tried to revamp the political science department by organizing it into a series of questions. And the idea was a question of design of institutions, questions of justice, and so on, saying
order, conflict, and violence. Yeah. The one I spent a year at Yale at the Center for Order, Conflict, and Violence, and it was around the time Ian was doing that. Yeah.
Yes, and it was, I mean, unfortunately, it was an innovation that didn't work and didn't get spread. But I thought, you know, that was not a bad way of trying to restructure and saying, we don't care whether you are a philosopher, whether you're a statistician, whether you're an historian. If you're making an original contribution to these enduring questions, we'd like to look at you. And so that seems to me to be, in a sense, rather than saying, we want somebody who studies Congress. We want someone who does Eastern European politics. We want someone who does, right, et cetera. It would be much more productive and fun, and also much more likely to have influence outside the discipline at all. I mean, who listens? Who besides hardcore political scientists read the APSR?
Even hardcore political scientists can't read the APSR. That was a big aha moment for me, is that you can only read within your subfield, even if you are a hardcore political scientist.
Right.
Fantastic.
And the truth, of course, is that what was interesting is I think someone tried to make those journals that you got a subscription to when you joined the APFA to be up to you and to give you a kind of menu of possible journals and take the APSR off the required list, right, as something that came, and as I remember, that failed, right, because the journal actually has to be bundled with membership in the discipline in order for it to survive at some level.
Fantastic. Jim, thank you very much for taking some time and talking about Tales of Discovery and your own personal trajectory. Jesse?
I have nothing to add. Thank you so much for your time.
A pleasure. I hope to come to Michigan one day, right?
Without question. The minute we're clear, I'm bringing you here for a week. I'll get my extra day back.
Okay,
Jim.
Hope to meet you in person soon.
Thanks a lot. I'm honored.
Thank you.
So are we. Thanks.
Talk to you soon.
Hello, thank you for listening to Raiders of the Lost Archive and for writings mentioned in this podcast, as well as what we're going to be doing in the future. Please feel free to look at archiveraiders.weebly.com.